It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week we're going to learn about a wine that's unlike most anything you've ever tried. It's a new favorite of uber sommeliers. Now, this big new discovery is 4,000 years old. And it's like so many things that are new revelations to us. Just when we think it's our own invention, we discover those ancient primitives nailed it a long time ago. Like how 5,000 years ago, Egyptians baked the first risen breads in clay pots buried in coals. Now compare that to our recent discovery, so-called five-minute bread doughs baked in deep pots in our ovens. Not too different. Well, stay with us for a lot more, including your calls, this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today it's the latest cult wine that sommeliers are lusting over. We head into the kitchen with our latest key three chef, Bill Smith. And along with backyard chickens and canning, hunting, perhaps the ultimate DIY, is coming back. Of course, for much of the country, it never left. But in human nature and in modern life, there's always a big disconnect from this idea. Yet with the ways we're rethinking our food, for some, hunting is now a classroom subject. Well, Jesse Griffiths is based in Austin, Texas, where he's famous for his farmer's market butcher shop, where he works with local meats and game, and his hunting classes, and for his new restaurant, Dai Due. Now, for him, hunting is all about eating well and something more. He's introducing much of what he's learned in his cookbook, A Field, A Chef's Guide to Preparing and Cooking Wild Game and Fish. Jesse, good to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So, Jesse, why do you hunt?
I like to be outdoors, and I love to fish. Hunting pretty much gave me an opportunity to kind of be distracted year-round. I love to eat wild game. I love to eat in general. So hunting yeah. is kind of an excuse to get outside and gather food. I've always been obsessed with food and where it came from, and hunting kind of gave me like an extra connection to that.
Why do you think that it's so hard for so many of us to think about hunting and then the field dressing, the cleaning of the animal? I mean, on one hand, it's logical. We're detached from it. But on the other hand, man's been hunting since, you know, we first started to move. And there's so much violence now in our society. And yet there's this disconnect from this idea of going out there to get our own food. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that people associate hunting with gun culture. And I think that hunting should be associated with food culture. A gun is a tool that you can use to get food, you know, like a hoe that you would use to, you know, turn the soil in your garden. I think that people are pretty leery about starting to hunt because they feel that the violence, which is inherent in the process, mm-hmm. is something that's insurmountable. You know, it's a difficult process. It's gonna be emotional. I think if it's not emotional for you, you shouldn't do it. But I think that we really want to convey the fact that this has been happening for a long time. It's right. It's a good way to approach food. It makes you think about your food in general as a whole more. And I think that people, if they experience it, or if they know people who are experiencing it in the right way, or they see it done and from a different perspective, then they're more likely to kind of change their ideas about what hunting is if they were opposed to it.
What is that emotional connection, in the sense you said if you don't feel an emotional connection, it's not right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're taking the life of something, that's a big deal, and it has some weight to it. You should always feel it. I mean, if it's a little dove, it's a big deer. It's the same. It was a life. That animal didn't expect its day to end like that. And you are then required to treat that with the utmost respect. And if you don't feel that, then I think that you're kind of missing the point. And that feeling translates into when you're preparing things, you just put more thought into it. You're required to. I mean, mm-hmm. You just mm-hmm. went through this long process. I mean, just getting the gear together, the, you know, traveling, the physical exertion, the excitement of the actual hunt, the processing of the animal, packaging, you know, making sausage, whatever. There's so much work involved. It just makes you feel and understand food at a more base level, I think.
Yeah, you wrote something in one of the stories. You were talking about hunting feral pigs with a woman, and that she harvested a pig, and as she went to begin the process of dressing it, she said, "Thank you, pig."
Yeah, and literally, that's what it was. I mean, she just said, I mean, if I remember correctly, she said, "You know, thanks, pig." You know, it was casual, but she meant it, you know. And I've also hunted with people, you know, that have shot their first deer, and they were like, can I have a few minutes alone, you know, because they really wanted to say, you know, thank you, because it was heavy, you know. It was a big deal for them.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not required that you know get on your knees and thank every animal, but think about it, you know, look at it, hold it in your hand, and realize that this process has begun, and you know, there's no taking it back. But it's also the beginning of something great. It's the beginning of a meal. You're going to sustain yourself, your family, your friends.
Right.
It's pretty wonderful if you can grasp the you know, the importance of all of it.
Let's talk about the other side of it, because cooking game is not something people do every day. And it's different than cooking most meats that we might get at the market. So what are some of the things we should know when we can get a hold of, you know, that game bird or that piece of venison?
Well, I mean, first off, it's going to be a lot leaner than grocery store or even farmer's market meats. You know, it was raised on a diet of like wild grasses or seeds, and it's going to have a different texture. It's not going to have all that fat and just be that sweet corn-fed animal that a lot of people are used to. So it's going to require probably, and I'm generalizing, a lot longer cooking.
Mm-hmm.
It could also require a lot shorter cooking, you know, where it's nice and rare and pink on the inside. So it's a little bit of a trick. The flavor is more intense, more rich. A lot of people have had bad experiences with game. They're like, oh, it tastes gamey. And it's like, yes, it does. But
it's game.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. Is there a favorite way that you have for, let's say, cooking a game bird? I'm thinking of, you know, something small like dove or that kind of thing.
Yeah, I just love grilled doves. I mean, salt, pepper, mm-hmm. olive oil, and a hot grill. That's more because I associate that with the night of a hunt, and we're all around a fire grilling our doves. And that's a lot of it, too. You know, a good meal is a lot more than just the food.
Right. Jesse, thanks for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lynn.
Jesse Griffiths is author of A Field, A Chef's Guide to Preparing and Cooking Wild Game and Fish. Now, whether you hunt or not, try Jesse's recipe for simple grilled doves. And in a pinch, you can always substitute quail, which you can find frozen in a lot of supermarkets. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, you know red wine. You know white wine, but what's new right now is orange wine. And I'm not talking about Orange Crush Zinfandel. Orange wine is seriously good drinking. And this is from a man named Food & Wine Magazine's Top Sommelier of 2012. He's Jeremy Quinn, and he's based in Chicago. Jeremy, good to have you with us.
Hello, Lynn. Nice to be on the program.
So I always thought that the color orange was the sign that a wine had gone over. It had been exposed to too much air.
That's true. Even in sommelier training, we're taught that wines that are white, that look beige in the glass, is a major flaw for a white wine because it's a result of oxidation. And orange wine is intentionally done that way. That's the big difference. It has a stronger electric hue to it. It's much more copper, and it's not as dull. as a flawed white wine is. It gets its color from extended contact with the skin, so it picks up color from the polyphenols and the anthocyanins that are within the skins.
Now, normally the way wine is made, if I've got it right, is that you crush the grapes with the skins and the seeds, and you let that start to ferment, and then fairly soon the skins and seeds are strained away, and then the wine, the liquid, is left to work.
Exactly.
And in this case, what happens with the wine to make the orange wine?
In this case, the skins and seeds are left in contact with the juice for anywhere from 13 days to 8 months of period of time. So,
boy, that's a very long time for wine,
It's a very long time, yes. And the remarkable thing about it is that the wine itself tends not to lose any freshness throughout. A big reason why the skins and seeds are separated at the start for a traditional white wine is to retain the acidity and the transparency and the bright flavors. And the great thing about orange wine is it keeps all that, but being treated more like a red wine, it picks up a lot more of secondary characteristics.
So what does it taste like?
It tastes radically cool, I think. It's got more adjectives to it than almost any other white wine that I would think of, or even red. You get flavors of caraway, cumin, cardamom, saffron, all of which make it a very fascinating pair, I find, with a whole range of foods that are somewhat thought of as challenging.
Well, I must say, immediately I'm thinking Indian food right there.
Precisely. A big pairing rule for those in the trade is usually to work with contrast, but with orange wines, I usually find that similar flavors tend to help the orange wine show best.
So is this a new idea?
Orange wine itself is a very ancient idea. It's very recent because people are beginning to look back to the origins of wine. A phenomenal book that was written recently by Patrick McGovern is called Ancient Wine. And it details some of the origins of wine in Mesopotamia and Georgia in southern Russia. Evidence shows that the grapes themselves were put into amphora and then buried underground and left there throughout the winter, opened up in the spring, and magically there was wine.
Holy cow. That sounds like kimchi.
Almost. The fermentation process is very similar, and sometimes the wines can be as crunchy.
Huh. So does anybody still do this burying in these vessels?
Yeah, several winemakers are experimenting with underground amphoras and even above ground amphoras as the best vessel to show the juice extended contact with their skins, because the particular shape of the barrel, how it reacts with the astral influences from the planets, and the particular oxidation within the barrel itself, protected by the skins at the top, the juice tends to roll within the amphora. So the ancients had it right with how they did it, many winemakers think. But that's not the only method. Many winemakers also show the juice extended time with the skins in barrel. But the amphora method is becoming much more popular.
And an amphora almost looks like an upside-down teardrop.
Exactly. The shape itself was designed by the ancients for that specific reason, and for travel also.
So what names should we look for if we want to get out and find this wine?
Orange wine is still a controversial term, so the best way to discover these wines is to look for the winemaker. There's a few names like Movia, Panevino, Votopivich, Foradori, and Kos. Those are a few names that are top in my mind, right next to Grobner, who are some of the leaders of the pack, if you will, with the recent revolution with orange wine.
And I guess it's still probably a little hard to find, huh?
It is. Although you mentioned the word trending earlier, this is definitely a trending style of wine, but it will never become wildly popular in terms of production. It can only be made in a very careful artisanal way. So it's kind of hard to find. You have to seek it out in specialized shops.
This is great. Jeremy, fascinating. Thank you.
Lynn, thanks. It's a great pleasure to be on your show.
You can find sommelier Jeremy Quinn at the restaurant Telegraph in Chicago. Now, find his orange wine recommendations on the website splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our podcasts, including chef's interviews from our Key 3 series, and dig into the recipe box. It's waiting, splendidtable.org. Well, we're going to be back with our latest Key 3 chef, Bill Smith of Crook's Corner. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. My private list of places you have to eat before you die includes a former gas station in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It's Crook's Corner Cafe and Bar, and it's made brilliant by Chef Bill Smith. This guy is an icon to all who revere great Southern cooking. And this is why Bill is our latest Key 3 chef. That is, one of our picks of the best cooks in the country. We ask each to tell us about the three key recipes they feel every cook should know. It's a one-on-one masterclass. And it doesn't get more unintimidating than working with Bill. He's so laid back, you might not realize what he's achieved until you notice the awards lining a small wall near the bar. Crook's Corner is pure retro. It's small, it's got white walls, and 1950s chrome and formica tables. It's a place to have fun. While back in the small kitchen, Bill's worked with the same crew of Latino cooks for years. They're family. And that's where he was when I knocked on the screen door to the kitchen.
Sweet demon, North Carolina, gave your daughter to me. She left me on that corner staring, knocked the wind out of me.
Are you?
I'm delighted to see you again. Welcome to the kitchen. You ever been back this way?
No, I've never been in the back door.
Sweet demon, North Carolina, gave your daughter to me.
Bill,
yes.
Key three recipes. What are your key three recipes for people who cook?
Okay, well, being from Eastern North Carolina, I'm going to say fried oysters, banana pudding, and collards.
Wow. Why fried oysters, banana pudding, and collards?
They're things I grew up on, and that's just what I think of when I think back. And it's sort of the foundation of what I do still.
Uh-huh. So where do you want to begin?
All right, we're going to fry some oysters.
This is not a bad thing.
Yeah, no, this is a good thing.
Okay.
I'm going to fly into the face of some people's opinion. I'm going to produce a batter with lots of crust.
Why? Tell me about this.
Oh, people say, oh, this is all bread. This is all, you can't taste anything for the crust. And yeah, right.
So there's
I do my fried chicken that way, too.
I mean, there are crust people and non-crust people.
People that see crust as sort of like some sort of minefield to get around on the way to the food, and others that, see, I love that.
But will I still be able to taste the oyster?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so you've got, all right, so we've got, we're
okay,
in the kitchen.
We're in the kitchen. We have self-rising flour.
Okay, white lily.
White lily, self-rising flour.
I always think of white lily means the South.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it used to be made in Knoxville. I think it's been bought up by somebody now. But and then we've got Maseca. It was a hat tip to my friends from south of the border who also work for me. And I discovered, this is interesting actually, I discovered this recipe by accident in a way. We always had, when growing up, we always had cornmeal.
Yeah.
So one time I was in New Orleans, and in New Orleans and Louisiana, they have all these brands that everybody loves, but you can only get them there.
Yeah.
So I went through the French Market on my way to the airport, really, and I grabbed all this stuff, and I got a seafood breader. And about a month or two later, we said, let's use that. So we fried this stuff, and we said, God, this is so good. What is this? But by then, the wrapper was in the dumpster, so I had to go out in the dumpster and fish through the trash, pull it out, and it said corn flour instead of cornmeal, right? So I used corn flour for years, and then one year I ran out when I needed it, and I ran to the corner store. There's a Mexican store in the corner. And they had Maseca, so it's the same thing. And so now we use Maseca because that's the best of all right.
So this is really, yeah. I'm feeling it. This is ground corn.
Yeah, this is for tortillas and tamales and stuff. We're going to use it tonight.
So it also has been treated with lye.
Yes, and it smells like it, yeah.
It smells like it.
Yeah.
So you're mixing.
Yeah.
So because you're most of your staff here is from Mexico, right?
Yes.
So.
Si o no way. Okay, so basically what you do is it's half and half.
So you've got a big, even had a nice square stainless steel. This is
anything,
your mixing bowl, and it's half self-rising flour,
which I'm trying,
and half of
this
corn flour.
You can get anywhere.
Yeah,
now.
Right.
But you mix it together, and like I said, I haven't measured anything in years, so I just sort of eyeball it.
Right. Okay.
And then this is a salt and pepper blend, and I like oysters to be salty myself. So.
Well, they are salty. They come
they
from
are
the sea,
anyway,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay, generous sprinkling of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
you're mixing it with your hands.
Mixing it with my hands.
Right,
and I probably stick my finger. Every time I give a class, I always end up sticking my finger in it and tasting it. And I warn everybody in the beginning. I said, okay, I'm here we go.
It's going to be fried in very hot oil.
In very hot oil.
Now, you just threw a bit of that flour mixture into the oil. What are you looking for?
Just to make sure that it's hot enough. You can sort of look at it. It just fries real quick.
So when it comes up and fries real quick and then browns.
If it's too cold, then they'll be all sogged out. You don't want that.
Okay. So when I'm heating my oil at home, I can drop a little bit of that flour and it's going to go golden?
Well, it'll bubble, basically, what you're seeing.
Okay.
Yeah, and it will come to the top.
What temperature are you looking for?
They say between 360 and 370.
Okay.
All this stuff is so old, who knows what it really is, but it's set on that. You just sort of watch, you know, no, this don't look so good, let's turn it up sort of thing.
I see. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, but that's usually a normal frying temperature.
Yeah, yeah. That's the science.
So these are fresh shucked oysters.
These are fresh shucked oysters from Grantsboro, North Carolina, which is down near where I'm from. And actually,
Southern North Carolina, right? Yeah. It all gets very confusing, but...
Well, you know, the East is very different from the West in North Carolina, I think. They're both nice, you know, but I'm an Easterner. My great-grandmother grew up at Cape Hatteras, so I'm way East.
Well, I understand in barbecue it makes a huge difference.
Fights.
Yes, exactly.
Don't go there.
So now you're dropping...
Yeah.
There's about a dozen oysters dropped into the flour mixture.
Uh-huh.
There's no liquid, no egg.
No, if I'm with larger seafood, like when we do soft shell crabs, I put them in buttermilk.
But this, you just put the oysters into the flour mixture.
This is pretty much it. And you want them to be well coated.
Okay, so now
trash can.
Now you're not dropping these directly into the fat.
No. You have to be very careful because you don't want to crowd them. When we're busy, we're a lot less careful than I'm being right this second.
But you're taking the fryer basket, the big rectangular basket.
So usually I hang it over the trash can, but it seems to have vanished right this minute.
So I'm making
a mess on the table, but that's
so,
all right.
So what you're doing now is you're just lining up the oysters. They're barely touching.
Yeah, you don't want them to be crowded because you'll make a dough rather than a crust.
And you'll have one large oyster fritter.
Yeah.
And those are going into that basket.
Into
and now,
the oil. Ready?
Oh, that sizzle.
There you go. And they cook very quickly. And there's a couple of... I like them a little underdone, but most people seem to prefer them a little brown. So I'd go with the public on this.
I have to say, I like my oysters, my fried oysters, very juicy inside, but crispy on the outside.
Well, these are a good size for that, so we should be able to manage that. And it's just, you just eyeball it, and in a second they'll be all pretty and brown. And
this is fry country, isn't it?
This is fry country. We do fried chicken all summer, but I serve it cold. I fry it in the morning and then let it sit all afternoon.
And it doesn't get soggy.
No. See, I've always thought one of the best things that can happen to you is to find cold fried chicken in your refrigerator the next day. And then one day when I thought, wait a minute, you're the boss. You can just do that if you want to. So we have cold fried chicken and potato salad and a big slice of watermelon and cucumbers and onions and then whatever else, maybe sliced tomatoes, and it's called a picnic.
How does that sound good?
Picnic plate. We do it all summer long.
That sounds swell.
As soon as the watermelons are up.
These oysters they've risen to the surface of the oil and they look like porcupines.
Yeah.
And they're just sizzling away.
Yeah, yeah.
And turning golden. You know, this is really exciting to see.
I'm thinking,
they're
good.
Big.
Yeah, they're
fritters.
Nice guys. All right, and I'm going to let them sit there 1 second, and then I'm going to...
They've been pulled out of the oil, and now they're just sitting over the oil draining.
And I'm going to grab this bowl. Look at the mess I made. This bowl was lined in a rag. A clean rag, of course.
A clean rag, yes.
And let them drain a second longer.
So that's to pick up any extra fat.
Yeah. And then we're going to hit them with some sea salt.
So coarse sea salt.
Yeah.
So you get that crunch.
Yeah. Okay, so now I think I've got a lemon or two over there. We serve these with all kinds of things.
Here you go.
Some people like cocktail sauce. Some people, we make a sort of a garlic mayonnaise out of roasted garlic. It's like a roasted garlic aioli. Lemons. And lately, and actually I'm doing this tonight with our tamales, sriracha sauce stirred into mayonnaise.
Oh, wow. Yeah, but you know, you've got beautiful oysters. You don't want to mess around.
I'm just going to do lemons with these.
Yeah. That took, from start to finish, what is this?
Zero.
Yeah, I mean, what, 10 minutes max?
Even, yeah.
And we're talking.
And we're still talking all day.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, is that fabulous.
Isn't that nice?
Right. So you've got wedges of lemon,
yeah.
A bowl of the fried oysters tucked with wedges of lemon, the coarse salt. That's it.
That's
they're beautiful. They're golden brown and crumbly looking.
People love these. I only serve them in the cool months. I grew up, that's another thing, growing up, we didn't eat oysters in the summer. We didn't eat them in hot weather. Now, I've had oysters in Louisiana where it's warm all the time. I think they're fine. It's the prejudice I have that I can't seem to get over. Plus, I rotate things in and out. People have things to look forward to and stuff.
Phil, thank you.
Not at all. Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you in the kitchen.
Bill Smith is chef at Crook's Corner Cafe and Bar in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Now, to hear the rest of our conversation about Bill's key three Southern recipe picks and get the recipes, they're fried oysters, banana pudding, and melting collards in pot liquor, head to the website, splendidtable.org. Bargain meal that tastes great? It's what we're all after. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are the masters of these finds, the homegrown gems. They keep track of them on their website, roadfood.com, and they check in here on a regular basis. Hey, you two, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, Lynn. You know, Buffalo, New York is known for many culinary wonders, among them, you know, the Beef on Weck sandwich, which we've spoken about with you, great ice cream parlors and candy stores, but one of the lesser-known features of Buffalo, New York, is really delicious ethnic food. And we were there fairly recently and went to a restaurant called Polish Villa 1. There's also a Polish Villa 2, but we only went to Polish Villa 1. And guess what? The Polish food there was really great. I mean, that kind of heartland Polish food that that we live on the coast really don't get the taste of unless we have a Polish relative who serves it to us.
Do you like Polish food, Lynn?
I haven't had a lot of it, and that's what I was going to ask you. Tell me the kinds of things you were eating.
Well, first and foremost, pierogi. You know, a pierogi can be like a big doughy, horrible thing, but a well-made pierogi, which is that dough that is quickly sautéed, so it's just barely crisp around the edges and filled with, let's say,
cheese,
sauerkraut or cheese or cabbage. Yeah. I mean, this is just, and then, of course, with a little kind of glistening butter on top and some onions that it's been sautéed in. I mean, that in itself is worth a trip to Buffalo.
I have to say that one of the best Wiener Schnitzels I ever had was here. And the mashed potatoes that came on the side were phenomenal. I mean, they had the skins on them. I think they were little red potatoes. You could get klusky noodles with chicken and mushrooms. Yeah. I mean, it's...
I cannot believe Jane has not yet mentioned the potato pancakes.
Well, I was getting there. I mean, I have to say that my family is Hungarian, and I was brought up in New York when I was a kid growing up, all along Second Avenue. There was one little Hungarian restaurant after another, similar to Polish Villa. I mean, just very, you know, workman-like places. They've all disappeared. And so when I go to the Midwest, where they still are, and I go to, what is the Hungarian place in Cleveland?
Balaton
or Polish Villa. I mean, I truly go into some sort of a fugue state, you know, of hysteria. And yes, the potato pancakes are worth the trip.
Now, is this run by a family? I would imagine it is, right?
It is family run. And one of the signals that indicated to us, even before the food came, that it was probably going to be a pretty decent meal was that when we walked in, all of the chatter in the dining room was in Polish. Very few people were speaking English in this restaurant. So that was a clue that we probably ought not to be ordering the hamburger.
And all the conversation, I had to say this, stopped momentarily while they figured out who the heck we were. Because they'd never
seen
us
before. That's always a good sign.
Always a good sign, yes.
And we weren't chased out. So
In fact, they were incredibly hospitable. When they realized we were kind of interested in what they were serving, every waitress came over and had suggestions of, do we want sour cream or applesauce with the potato pancakes? Everyone had a little advice to give us while we
were
eating.
And the fruit crepes for dessert.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Palachinki. Yeah. I mean, oh, my God. I could eat that all day long.
Oh, this sounds so good.
It is.
It's worth a trip. Absolutely.
Yeah, you have done your work well. I appreciate this. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators and minds behind roadfood.com. Now, check out their latest finds, too, at splendidtable.org.
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said, look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time to talk. We're connecting with you. Call us, 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Let's see now, who is up first? Adrian's on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina. So, Adrian, what do you want to talk about? What is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a bunch of different eggs that I got in my awesome CSA box. I have pheasant, quail, partridge, and guinea hen eggs.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is, and, I mean, how many do you have of each?
I have a couple of each.
That's amazing. That's really, what a great farm you're working with.
I know. It's Papa's Fed CSA, and they're really wonderful, but I just don't know what to do with them.
Well, you know, I know this sounds insane, but when is anybody ever going to have a chance to taste those things side by side?
Right.
Why don't you do this? Why don't you do this? Get a couple of friends together.
Okay.
You know, maybe no more than six. And what you're going to do is take each two eggs. Now, of course, two quail eggs.
Tiny.
Yeah, really tiny, really tiny, smaller than a golf ball. Mm-hmm. But my thought is, wouldn't it be wonderful if you lightly scrambled each pair, put it out at room temperature, right? Mm-hmm. And then, and maybe just with a little salt and pepper, and do them in a little teeny bit of butter or a little olive oil, mm-hmm. just a little, because you want to taste the egg. And everybody can taste them. And then, maybe you should have four people. And then what you do is you can have some sour cream, some chopped scallions, you know, some chopped onion, a little bit of smoked salmon, and you have some bread that you've rubbed with olive oil,
yes.
and you've toasted on the grill, mm-hmm. and then you have a big batch of scrambled eggs from a chicken maybe, or a duck, or an ostrich, and everybody has a big, beautiful brunch, and they help themselves. Yeah, they just put stuff on the bread, and then they pile on stuff on top of the eggs. But they get a chance to taste the difference.
Yeah.
Even if they're taking a tiny, tiny taste, I would love to be able to know what a pheasant egg tastes like.
Yeah, especially compared to the other eggs.
Yeah, or I mean, I've had plover's egg, and I have quail's egg, but I don't remember them very well.
Yeah.
But I think that would be such a fun thing to do.
Maybe so, with notepads or something like that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Huh. Rate them on a rate of 1 to 4.
Yeah.
Or just describing what they taste like, because they're so curious.
Mm-hmm.
This will only happen once in your life. I'd make a party out of it.
That sounds like a great idea. Thanks a lot, Lynn.
You're welcome.
Take
Bye.
Care. Bye.
You know, you don't have pheasants and quails and all those things in your backyard usually laying eggs. I mean, when do you see a partridge egg? All right. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook. Check us out. Go to splendidtable.org. Lots of good stuff on that site. And you can send us an email or call us, 800-537-5252. Okay. This week's trivia challenge is up. And the question is, what did three French cows do that is now changing the steak in France? We're going to be back with that answer and more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're going to be connecting with you in a moment, so get in touch. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what did three French cows do that is now changing the steak in France? Well, the answer is they drank two bottles of very fine red wine a day for about 4 months, along with the rest of their dinner, which, by the way, was barley, hay, and grapes. Chefs loved the resulting steaks. The grapes and the wine made beef that caramelized beautifully and tasted just swell. So now France has a new beef brand, Vin Bovin, and herds of inebriated cows in its pastures. Okay, it is back to the phones. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have Mary on the line from Medane, North Carolina. Mary, am I pronouncing that correctly?
No, actually, it's Medin. That's all right.
Medin, excuse me.
That's all right.
Excuse
it's not very well known.
So what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question about bruschetta. It's one of my most favorite Italian dishes, and I've noticed whenever I've gone to the really fine Italian restaurants, I've gotten all kinds of exotic, really interesting toppings like mushrooms and goat cheese and eggplant, and I really love that. But then when I go on the Internet to look for a recipe to make it at home, which I would love to do,
right,
I just find, you know, your basic everyday tomato and basil, and although that is very good, I'd like to find something more exciting like what I get in the restaurants, but that's all I can find is tomato and basil, so I'm wondering if you have any good ideas.
Well, if you think of the bruschetta as an open sandwich,
mm-hmm.
you know, put that in your head, and you think about almost anything can go on an open sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
So you put a smear of goat cheese, okay,
mm-hmm.
a little chopped raw onion, a little bit of olive oil and chopped up arugula.
Oh.
You follow me?
Yeah.
See, suddenly you're no longer thinking bruschetta, you're thinking, and by the way, I always mix this up. It's either bruschetta or bruschetta, and I speak Italian, I should know. But anyway, you see where I'm saying? Get the bruschetta out of your head. It's an open-faced sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't it be fabulous in your neck of the woods to have some shrimp?
Oh, yeah.
You know, some of the wonderful local shrimp, and you've put a little garlic and olive oil and toasted that bread, and you pile on that shrimp, and then you crush, just with the back of a fork into a bowl, some cherry tomatoes, and you put those on top, and you sprinkle a tad of chili on that with lemon.
Oh, that sounds great.
So you see, that's where you can go with it. And as far as things like eggplant and roasted peppers, those are all things you can do on the grill. And then if you want to marinate them in some way, fine. But otherwise, a grilled piece of eggplant, just, you know, cut up and just laid on top of that bread that you've rubbed with the garlic.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just heaven. A little good olive oil. If you want some bitter greens, that's a nice contrast. But that's just fabulous.
That's great. Well, you know, is bruschetta, you think, a very vegetarian kind of meal? Because I never heard of it with meat on it. Do you think that would
work? Well, sometimes it is done with meat. Sometimes it's done with things like, pancetta, which is the bacon cut that in Italy it's rolled up.
Oh, yeah.
And it's cured. It's done with ham. It's done with salami. And it's done with mixtures, where you might have the grilled eggplant and thin slices of a spicy salami or just a delicious salami on top of that. So you can really make it anything you want it to be. And we were just talking about this. The idea of a slice of good, you know, chewy bread, mm-hmm. toasted, smeared with garlic and olive oil, that's a shovel.
Yeah.
We were talking about eating with your fingers recently and about, you know, when you have some tomatoes and you've got some good greens and whatever, you just kind of tuck them up onto that bread and you eat it. And in Italy, that's often what you do.
Yeah.
So it can be anything you want. Leftover meat that you've, you know, that the cold lamb or warmed up a bit with some chutney on it. It doesn't have to be Italian.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you. You give me some great ideas. You really expanded my mind onto this. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Enjoy it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You know, I have to say, it is really the great fallback supper as far as I'm concerned. Anything you have in the fridge. Grill stale bread. Put the garlic and the olive oil on it, right? And then take whatever condiments you have around, throw that on top of the bread, and then start piling on those leftovers. It is dynamite, and everybody kind of eats whatever they want. It's we kind of call it the open fridge supper of Friday night. We've got Pedro calling from L.A. Pedro, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, I want to talk about tequeños. You know, my girlfriend and I, we love cooking, and we've tried making tequeños. What we can never figure out is what kind of cheese to use to replace, you know, the one that's used on the originals, because we can't really find that in California.
Okay, let's step through exactly what a pequeño is.
All right, well, a tequeño is a Venezuelan, sort of like a pastry. It's a dough filled with cheese that is fried, and then the cheese melts when the temperature rises.
Right.
It originates from the town of Los Teques, which is very close to the capital.
So essentially it's a cheese pastry, right?
Something like that.
What kind of cheese is usually used in it?
They use something called, you know, the nondescript title of queso blanco, which means white cheese.
And it's a pretty mild cheese, isn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. Now, I would imagine you'd be able to find that in a lot of markets in L.A.
Well, there's I imagine there's different kinds of queso blanco. I mean, so I'm sure Mexico has their own kind. Queso blanco, El Salvador has their own kind.
And you want the one from Venezuela?
Right.
Ah, okay. Now it's getting clearer. Now, I'm not familiar with that cheese. What does the cheese taste like? Because then we can see if we can find something that's easily gotten that's going to come close to it.
Well, it's a little salty.
Yeah.
And it melts when heated into a gooey kind of texture.
Is it strong flavored?
No, it's not very strong.
Okay, this is what, here, let's try this on. What would happen if, now, feta cheese, you know, which is Greek, but it's made now in the United States and you can find it in every supermarket, tends to be salty. It's a fresh cheese that's put in a salt brine. It tends to be very salty. But I wonder what would happen if you mixed that feta cheese with a bit of mozzarella cheese, especially some fresh mozzarella, you know, the kind that you can get in tubs and it comes in liquid? Because
yep.
That's really creamy. And if you were to kind of mash those two together, you'd get some saltiness, you would get that lovely melting quality, and also you get a real milkiness from that mozzarella.
Interesting.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's always hard to duplicate something that comes from somewhere else. But I'm wondering if that salty feta, which also has some nice flavor behind it, a little bit of that mixed in with the mozzarella. And if you can't get the one in tubs, you could even use the brick one. But the one in tubs is pretty special, you know, and it tends to be very, very milky, really delicious.
Yeah.
A little bit of those two, and you don't need a lot in the pastry, and then try that. I would try that combination.
All right. Great. A two cheese blend.
Okay. All right.
All right. And thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org, or call us, 800-537-5252. Randy in Georgia had a question. He says, I'm having a hard time finding juniper berries, and I was wondering if there was a suitable substitute for them. Now, juniper berries have this flavor of menthol. It's almost a strange mint pine flavor, because they come from a member of the pine family, and a kind of peppery undertaste. And there's nothing that is exactly like a juniper berry, except two things come to mind. One is a Sichuan peppercorn, which I think if you can't find the juniper berries, Sichuan peppercorns are a lot harder to find. But the other thing is, believe it or not, is Dutch gin. It's called Genever. And Dutch gin, like all gins, is made with juniper berries, except you can really taste the juniper berries. Now, one bottle of Dutch gin is probably going to last you for 10 years, but the reality is maybe 3 or 4 tablespoons of that into whatever you were going to put the juniper berries in is going to give you that flavor. And it's not bad stuff to sip chilled either. So thanks for the great question, Randy. Call us, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. And we've got Ellen calling from Masonville, Colorado. Ellen, hi.
Hi, Lynn.
Are you up in the mountains?
Yeah, about 70 miles northwest of Denver.
Oh, right, right. The gorgeous country up there.
It is.
Now, did you have a question by any chance?
Yes, ma'am. It is about fudge. I have a problem making it every batch I make sugars or crystallizes.
Okay.
Now, and I'm wondering if you can tell me what I'm doing or not doing.
Are you stirring it?
Yes. I use a heavy 4-quart saucepan.
Right. That sounds good.
And I must admit, I do not use a thermometer.
Okay. Now, I cannot remember my fudge temperatures. because what fudge is really about is boiling sugar, because you're making candy. And as you boil sugar, it goes to different stages, and they'll call, like, for instance, 200 and something is the softball stage.
Uh-huh.
That's where you have something like caramel, right?
Yes.
And then you go higher. You go to 200 and whatever, and it's hardball stage. That's where you get a crackle. And I really think you should get yourself a candy thermometer.
Okay.
You really need it. It's going to just save you aggravation. And if you can, don't stir it. As it boils, brush down with a dampened brush any crystals that get thrown up on the side of the pan. Okay? This is the standard practice with any kind of sugar syrup. And really what fudge is sugar syrup with stuff in it.
Uh-huh.
So because every time you stir it, what's happening is the crystals that have only come to temperature 210 are mixing with the sugar crystals that have come to 200, whatever, and they get confused, and then they make this grainy, awful, terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
So get a candy thermometer, check your fudge recipe for what temperature it's supposed to be, and then you should be home free.
Okay, so I can use that brush while it's at that rolling boil?
You can use the brush through the whole process, because the idea is you're quickly just washing those crystals that are thrown up, that stuff that's thrown up, right back into the mixture.
Okay.
So that's all you have to do, and then just check that temperature.
Okay, and so leaving it in that pan to cool is not an issue then?
Only it shouldn't be. A lot of people like to get it out of the pan to cool it quickly, because that pan is going to hold heat for a long time.
True.
And it takes a while for sugar syrups to cool down. So I would say, again, it depends on your recipe, but I would say get it out of the pot and into a pan to cool. It's just a good idea.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
Okay, thank you, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
Melissa is on the line from Petaluma, California. Melissa, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I'd like to talk to you about maple syrup.
Mm. What about maple syrup?
Well, I had a friend just return from Quebec, and so she brought me back a can of syrup, and she also brought me back a bottle of, I don't exactly know what it is because it's in French, but I think it's maple syrup coulisse.
And
I don't normally eat, the can of syrup is a big metal can, and I don't normally eat pancakes or waffles, and so I was kind of just looking for alternative ways to use syrup.
Okay. You don't eat pancakes, you don't eat waffles, but you've got this ton of probably dynamite maple syrup. Wherever you like sweet, tart, or sweet, spicy flavors, for instance, wherever you might add sugar to a main, to a savory dish, or honey, that kind of thing, you can use maple syrup. So let me give you an example. Okay, let's say we take some butternut squash, cut it into chunks, throw it into a big skillet with a bit of oil in it. I like olive oil, and maybe some onion, maybe some garlic. Get it browned, get those, pieces browned. They're maybe an inch chunk.
Yeah.
Add to that a bit of vinegar, a bit of water. Let that cook just until the squash is beginning to get tender. And then what you do is you add the maple syrup. You add a bit of maple syrup because you want to get taste as you go, sweet, tart flavor. And let that cook until it forms a glaze.
Okay.
Do the same thing with carrots.
Yeah,
because glazed, maple glazed carrots are really, really delicious. Then think about this. A pork tenderloin, put big, deep slashes in it. Mix up maple syrup, a lot of black pepper. Okay, some cinnamon, some cumin, and some coriander. And what you do is smear that all over that tenderloin, put it in the fridge overnight, and the next day, slow grill it or slow pan cook it on top of the stove. And you'll get all these wonderful spices. Just think of maple syrup is sugar with a lot of delicious complex flavors in it.
Okay.
So, whenever you think of a barbecue sauce, a marinade, a glaze, a sweet sour, whatever, use the maple syrup.
Okay. And then this coulis,
I think is how it's pronounced. Coulis. And probably what this is some sort of mixture that maybe has fruits in it or dried fruits. And by the way, cooking dried fruits in maple syrup to make a compote, that's another dynamite thing. And it's probably something like that it's like a sauce. And
it looks kind of like honey almost. It's a lighter color. I don't see any chunks of anything.
Okay, then I would taste it. It may be a very delicate maple syrup. It may be a specially delicate one. And that's one that you may want to just drizzle over, roasted sweet potatoes.
Okay.
Or if you do roasted vegetables with roasted grapes in it, and then toss a little bit of that maple syrup with it just before you serve it. Would be fabulous. Okay. It's probably the really delicate, classy maple syrup.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I really love your show. I listen to it on podcast.
Hey,
so.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And thanks for a great question.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This business about maple syrup, the reality is that the stuff that's usually cheaper, if you can get it, is the stuff I like best for cooking. The grade B, the darker, more flavorful maple syrup. And the grade A and fancy and all of that are the more delicate ones. And when it comes to cooking and you want that big, robust flavor, go for the grade B. Save some money. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. You have a good week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Robert L. Walk, who said, "Carotene, the definition? An adolescent carrot." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org. You can find just about everything you heard here today there. And you can get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcast, make a visit to our online store, and oh, don't miss our newest project, a series of ebooks called Eating In with Lynn. You're going to find it all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.